legend lives on from the Chippewa on down at the big lake they call Gitchagumi. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. Then later that night when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling? The wires made a tattletale sound and the wave broke over the railing.
Whatever you want.
And every man knew. Now up to Christian Yelich. Here it is. Yelich sends one to right center and deep. Get up! Get up! Get out of here and gone for Yelich. He has tied the game with a booming home run. He got it all. Tied up 4-4 on a big home run the pitch. Ryan Braun sends it to left center and deep.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here.
Well, welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. In case you didn't know, that was the late, great, very unique Bob Uecker on the call. Doesn't get any better, does it?
No, sir, it does not.
The you got to flip a switch because I can't hear you. Whatever switch you got to flip. Do we have Professor Lou?
We should.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for playing The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald this morning, which is one of my all-time favorite songs. Just a terrific piece of music, but a little long for a full introduction.
I read a headline the other day, and I didn't read the article. Something about some huge discovery down at the wreck of the Fitzgerald. I mean, what was that all about?
I didn't see that. I thought they had determined. Once they found the wreck, I thought they had determined a cause, but maybe not.
When it went around some area, I think they thought it banged the ground, didn't it? There was something in the. It hit bottom somewhere and it caused it to go down? They think some area he's supposed to go all the way around, but in the storm he went too close, something like that. Anyway, S&P futures down 31, NASDAQ futures down 102. They were down more than that, but we're still down. Oil's back up another 384. 91.09 is we're going to... Who the hell knows why the market's going down or up and what people are thinking or not. It's hard to...
Let me throw something out because this was something that you raised with respect to the Venezuela invasion. So a couple of senators have requested that the Consumer Products Commission, hold on a sec, the CPTC or whatever it is,
Secure Product Safety Commission,
CFTC. Okay. There we go. Asking the Commodities Futures Trading Commission.
Yep.
Have asked that they investigate and shut down Polymarket and comparable betting on the Iran war, and are upset over precisely the issue that you raised, potential insider trading, especially with respect to the conduct of combat operations. And so, you know, this rapidly moves us from an area of foreign policy betting to tactical military, you know, singular, granular tactical military decisions about which people could very well have solid inside information, or could be in a position, much like athletes having bets placed on their individual performances, could well, you know, directly impact a bet. And so so the request has gone out that they shut this down. And apparently there have been some bets on Polymarket and something called Kalshi, which I'm not familiar with, that indicates some betting on the strikes in Iran. So
I got a
policy issue there.
And I got a missive. I'll see if I can find it in my emails here from one of our guys who contributes to the show. It had to do with the same guy that made a fortune and whether we're with the Venezuela thing is now betting that. I'll find it here before I lob it out there. But
well, nobody knows. My understanding was nobody knew who that guy was that bet on Polymarket. It was an anonymous bettor. He made $400,000 on a $30,000 bet that Maduro would not be in power by the end of January. And so, my understanding was that nobody knew who that guy was. Well, I mean, maybe somebody does, but not
well,
publicly.
If you paid him, how do you not know who he is? We had to go
someplace.
Well,
it goes to an account.
Okay, but there's a name on
simple.
It.
No, not necessarily. So I mean, I haven't seen. Let me put it this way: the NSA probably knows who the guy is, but I doubt. I haven't seen any public revelation of the guy's name.
Well, because we don't know doesn't mean you can't find the guy.
You don't think somebody's tried?
The whole story that if somebody remember the story about 9/11, we could never find the people who bought the puts. Bullshit. If the trade came through PTI, there's an account, there's a name on it, there's a bank associated with it, there's a person. They don't want to find out.
I will guarantee you that there are hundreds of news people looking for that guy's name.
Oh,
that,
news people, that, yeah, that, but I'm saying
that better's name.
I'm saying the right they don't want us to know who the guy is. That's the story. I think.
Who is they?
But do you think if it's somebody inside the administration or somebody knows there, they're gonna say
who is they?
You think the people? I think somebody could tell if you used your credit card to buy coffee this morning. How do you think opening these accounts? How did he get them the money?
Who has the motivation to block something like this?
Somebody who's an inside trade. Who do you think the people who trade ahead of oil news or presidential announcements or anything else? What do you think?
Okay, I mean, we can identify. There may be certain government officials that could block something like this. My response, you know, I don't buy off on the giant, you know, they in the sky that you know has the invisible hand reaching through all these transactions. There may be, you know, some government official somewhere who has a basis to.
Are you there? What happened to our Lou?
That's a good question.
A number of other government agencies that have every incentive to block this or to uncover this and dig at it. So I'm not convinced that there's some conspiracy to hide that individual.
I'm not saying what I'm saying is there's a conspiracy to not let us know who it is. I mean, look at insider trader cases. Look, the only ones that have ever been prosecuted are people out of this country. Insider trading goes on. I mean, you think, by definition, when the Fed does something, the people who are the people like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, their job is to go out and buy bonds or sell bonds ahead of the stuff and turn around and give it to the Fed. It's by anybody's definition, that's an insider trade. But I mean, the idea that you can't find out who the person is absolutely preposterous because you got to pay the guy.
I'm just saying, you know, either. Well, let me back up. This is an interesting question. the idea that there is some conspiracy to not investigate this is, I think, a reach. And I'm guessing that there is an investigation going on. It's just a question of finding the information. So anyway, my point is, this was something that you had raised in January. It is apparently still going on. I think there is legitimate concern that you may have. I mean, what my nightmare, the nightmare that I think of, is some lieutenant colonel.
By the way, your guy's name in Iran is a user on Kalshi named MAGA My Man. Made over $500K okay. betting on the Iran war and its leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, just before he was killed. Another user, Bulky Bull, correctly predicted 9 separate military events and walked away with 90,000. He's currently betting big the U.S. ground forces will enter Iran. If he's right, he'll clear another 100K.
Okay. Well, so my concern is that we have some colonel or some E8 that's plugged into either making the decisions or works for somebody who is, and is just, you know, racking these things up. That would not surprise me a bit. I think it's more likely, and that's very obviously horrifically dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's more likely that it's some FSB guy or some Chinese intel person that is, you know, hacked into our systems and is making projecting bets based on some kind of AI interface. But regardless, it's a legitimate concern. It's one you raised. And I'd love to see, you know, see the commodities trading guys go after this and try to dig into it a little bit and figure out what's going on.
Well, I had a, you know, sometime when you hang around.
So Tom, let me just ask, because I'm never clear on gambling and exactly how it works, because I don't have the mentality, number one, or the experience. If they're betting on this on the market, are there people taking bets against them? Is that how this gets funded?
There's two kinds of these things, and I'm guessing these are number two. The first is, if you make the bet, like if you make a bet with a gambling site, you know, you have the Bulls are 6-point underdogs, you bet on the Bulls, you're betting essentially against the house. You bet, which acts like a casino. There's no person on the other side of that trade. Now, I think with some of these other places now, and I don't know the specific ones, but I know they have them, is they are essentially an exchange, and you bet with somebody on the other side.
Right. So
like right now, if you called up PTI after, well, you could do it now, I suppose, but you could do it, say, after the opening, showing my age, you want to buy 1,000 IBM, we go to the exchange. We buy the 1,000 IBM for you, but you buy it from someone.
Right.
That I think that's how these places work. But I'm not positive, because I think they're all different. I don't think you necessarily are betting against Kaushi, wherever their place is.
Like no, the, and so okay. so that was yeah that so that's my question is are they are there is there a body of people out there that are counter betting or somebody goes, all right, I'm going to bet that this guy that supposedly is the supreme leader of Iran that was just named, Khamenei's second oldest kid.
Yeah,
I'm going to bet that guy in fact is dead, and is not. I'm going to bet he's like Joe Biden, you know, not Campos Mentis, or some other bet. There are people on the other. Apparently, there is another bettor somewhere or group of bettors that will come in and say, "Yeah, we'll take that bet, and we'll cover it if it goes at this, level."
We have to have somebody on one day, because remember the Venezuelan thing, the part about the invasion, and they didn't pay because they said it wasn't an invasion.
Yes,
I have a feeling that those bets must have been at the house, because if it was another person, why would they care?
Right.
So that particular site must be you bet against the house.
The house says it'll cover it.
Yeah.
Boy, that's so... Anyway, I'm...
This is pretty... It's all pretty crazy. I mean, it comes down to it's not a big theme of mine. Lou, we got to get people... Look at the labor report last month. we got another million people that aren't doing anything. Don't we need to get people a job, for God's sake, so they'll do all this stuff all day long? What is this? How counterproductive is all this crap?
Well, it's very counterproductive. I don't know. Our labor participation rate, I thought, was going up. I mean, it's not going up dramatically,
going
but it's going up.
It's going down. Last couple of months, it was down bad.
Well, so is that, what does that reflect? Does that reflect the fact that we have a lot fewer government jobs, or does that reflect, would that reflect the fact that, what, a million people have left the country?
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, Carl, actually last month he finally got enough things in front of him. He said the whole thing about a million people being here and a million people leaving, he says, it's all a lie. They're not in the numbers at all.
Okay, they're not in the numbers.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in any event, I haven't seen the participation rate, but
this is, Carl will be bitching at me if he's on, but this is the number. As of the February numbers, now these are the adjusted numbers, the household survey. We've got a population of 275 million, call it. 170 million are in the what they call the workforce, Lou. And this is what's confusing. This is why when they give these numbers, they really kind of sucks. There's 170 million people that are in the workforce, defined as having a job or actively looking for a job.
Right.
Right. So there's 163 million people that are employed, slightly less than last month. There's 7.5 million people that are actively looking for a job, which is a little more than last month. And there's 104 million people, the highest on record, 283 that kind of, we don't know what they're doing. They're alive, but they could be students, they could be retired. There's not anything sinister about most of them, but it also means, that's why when you look at the unemployment number, and the amount of people unemployed, it's 7.5 million out of 111 million.
Right.
That you somehow determine that these 7.5 million are looking for a job and not just sitting home all day. But if you fall off the unemployment rolls, they take you from column A and put you in column B. You could be looking for a job harder than you were when you were getting your unemployment thing. So the most useless number is this unemployment being carved out of this total number. The number you want to look at is 162 million people working versus 111 million people not working. Now, again, some very legitimately. And that number is now 59.3% of the people that are working. And it's down a little bit. It's down from, like, last April. That number, really, for us to be healthy in terms of federal deficit and everything, needs to be about 63. And
right.
We have not been 63 since 2007.
Oh, I know the number.
Yeah.
This has been a constant theme for me and some other people. But okay, so that explains that. I guess the short answer is, we this goes back to the issue about productivity and engaging people in the workforce. And so, one of the things that we're seeing with in the employment world, you know, because that's my legal area, is the issue of what's going to happen with AI and how much AI is going to affect the hiring of mid-level management, but even lower level management and lower level functionaries at what used to be entry level positions, and how that the rise of artificial intelligence merged with effective mechanization is going to affect that. And from an employment lawyer's perspective, are we going to be looking at statutes that are going to limit the use of AI to try to preserve a number of these positions?
But it's also, Lou, it's a figment of the news imagination right now. I mean, one of the listeners sent me a study.
Specifically, what is artificial intelligence?
Not that it is going to affect stuff. I get that part, but the stuff. One of the some big firm, and it wasn't Challenger Grain Christmas. Those are guys. It wasn't them. It was somebody almost as big. They did a study and they got all of
By the way, I've always laughed at the idea that a name partner in a major consulting firm has the last name of Christmas.
Yeah, well, it's, he probably didn't like it either. But
it's like having the last name New Year.
Yeah, Easter. But he, anyway, these guys came out and said of all the people who have been laid off in the last 3 months that have been laid off because of AI, 66% of the firms don't even have AI. You know, so it's one big excuse. Now, that doesn't mean that the other 33% aren't legitimately laid off because of AI. They probably are. But you look around this area, Lou, there's all kinds of construction jobs. I don't know if they're because of Biden's bill or they just bridges that are falling apart. You can't find anybody to work on them.
Well, that, I mean, and I think,
and you talk about the, how, you know, various opinions on how much more military stuff do we need in terms of bullets, in terms of missiles, in terms of God knows what. Obviously, we're blowing them up every day. Those people, if they go to a second shift, they're not turning on the computer. They need people. I mean, it's not like we don't have a demand for people.
Oh, no, agreed.
There.
Agreed. But in a place like, in an industry or in a company like Anduril, for example, or Palantir, AI is supplanting even skilled trades because they're using machines to put the products together. And I mean,
but robotics has been a dramatic progression for the last 40 years.
Yep.
Just another, I mean, how many,
but the artificial, but when you couple it with artificial intelligence,
it's just another progression. I'm with you, but
it's a significant progression, and it eliminates more jobs. I'm thinking more along the lines, however, of things like fast food, the food industry, and how quickly and you know, effectively, an artificial intelligence system coupled with, again, you know, an automated preparation system, how quickly that stuff can move to basically eliminate a lot of those jobs. And the irony is that a number
of... So AI is going to fry the hamburgers?
Oh, yeah. Well, what's crazy is that you have all these jurisdictions, especially large cities, where push-up or an increase in the minimum wage has making it economically ridiculous or unfeasible to hire people for the jobs. So you mechanize because the mechanization is cheaper. Story from London, okay? I walked into a McDonald's in London across the street from my hotel and was getting breakfast. I think there were two people in the and the place was packed. I think there were two people in the in McDonald's employees in the entire place. There was a manager and somebody just watching to catch any mistakes that were made. You walked in, there were stand-up screens, and I'm sure you've seen these,
yep.
Stand-up kiosks where you touched the screen, you had a touch screen, and you picked everything you wanted, you know, how you wanted your Egg McMuffin, how you wanted your bagel sandwich. You touched all that in, and it gave you every choice that was available. You touched that in, and then in the back, because I could see it, the order was processed, the egg was fried, the bacon was fried, or the bacon was ready, and it moved to assemble the sandwich. It was bagged with a napkin and whatever. There was the manager and the other person that were there were looking to make sure that what was coming out was matched to an order. And you know, there wasn't nobody there.
Well, but I mean, everybody, I think some of this stuff, looted. There's, I don't know. We could expand the discussion as much as we want because this is a discussion that I really love to be in, because you look at where
well,
exactly
this hits in your sweet spot. It's in my sweet spot.
But I mean, you are making the assumption. Okay, and I don't want to say this. You're being communicated to in an area like it happens to me in areas that I don't know. It's not exactly my area. You're being communicated to in a way where you're sort of I won't say the term brainwashed, but I mean, I spent all morning yesterday going through the CPI numbers. All the way home, listening to the radio. Everything they said was wrong. Everything they said was wrong. But that was the message. But you look at automobiles. Now, if you take a course in labor economics, every sort of advancement where you and I work at a place and everything we got to do, we pick up. There's no track. We got to push carts from place to place. If we mechanize a little bit, you and I now all of a sudden don't have to do the mundane stuff. We can do some of the better stuff. And we're going to become more and more efficient. The idea being we're going to make a little bit more because we're more efficient. Company gets to make some more. Everybody gets a piece of the efficiency pie. The people who you buy the machine from, well, they're going to make a profit. So they get a little piece of it. Everybody gets a little piece. That's what's called efficiency. That's what's called growth. That's friggin' America, for God's sake. But when you look back and you say, people talk about cars, you're going to get not some dummy, but you're going to get somebody who says, well, God, yeah, cars are expensive because look what these auto workers are making. And I can look at them and I go, by the way, Joe, what are they making? Well, what do you mean? A lot. Tell me how much. Well, they have no idea, okay? And I'm going to say that cars 40 years ago took 50 man-hours. Now I think they take 25. Yet the car has gone from, the pickup truck has gone from 12 grand to 80. So tell me exactly where the savings is. There might be a little bit there, but it's a pimple on the ass of an elephant. Where's the rest of the dough? I mean, with all this efficiency, the idea is if you become more efficient at your law firm, okay, and all of a sudden instead of charging $400, you guys can do the same work for $300, that's supposed to be savings to me who needs a lawyer, that now instead of sending you guys a check for $20,000, I can send you a check for $15,000 for the same sort of work. And oh, by the way, the other $5,000 I can spend on something else. And those people go out and hire people, whatever they have to do. This is how this is all supposed to work. It's not working like that at all. I mean, that's I think part of it. Now, why isn't it, is the question. Every savings you make somewhere should actually come back to me, give me more money to spend somewhere else. This is the theory of all. That's kind of the real reason why I do this show. All these theories, all of a sudden lately, they don't seem to work. Now, the question is why? Where's the wrench going in this thing? Every place to where all of a sudden, wait a minute. We're instead of paying somebody 50 hours for the car, we cut back to 30. The lady who runs GM all of a sudden makes $40 million a year instead of $2 million a year. Well, that's not exactly the way this is supposed to work. Now, what does that mean? There's no competitive industry in CEOs and stuff? Maybe. Does that mean boards, conspire? That's a bad word I know from talking to an attorney. Does that mean boards conspire to not ever go out and say, gee, how much can we really get to get somebody to run GM? How much do we have to pay him? $5 million? Do we have to pay him 50? Do we have to pay him 60? Do you have to pay Elon Musk, $1 trillion? I mean, there's no competition at that level. So where is the money going? Somehow it's going from one group has to be amazingly competitive. I mean, it's incredible where people that are successful with money will bitch a blue streak about somebody making $20 an hour when they should be making $16. Okay. Yet nobody ever bitches about a lawyer that makes $1,200 an hour that probably could live easily on $800. You know, I mean, somewhere along the line we stop talking about competitive stuff because nobody wants to be on the competitive side of this, do they? I mean, I look at going for breakfast. Audrey and I go to breakfast.
I can tell you that the competitive business in law is pretty cutthroat.
Well, it is in getting the person, but you guys never say, gee, the big firm in Chicago, they want to charge $1,000, I'll charge you $500. That doesn't happen.
It happens all the time.
Well,
the problem is that there's a countervailing pressure in selection of professional services that works against going for the most economically correct choice, and that is the reputational issue. So my firm constantly underbids big law for services.
Okay.
We are very efficient. where we don't have gigantic gigantic payroll. We're not paying lawyers, you know, $3-5 million a year for basic work. And our hourly rates reflect that. But if you're the general counsel of a company and you have a fairly serious piece of litigation, you can come to us. We have people with lots of experience, or you can go to another firm that charges three times or four times as much, but has a better reputation. And when you're the general counsel, you got to go before the board. They say, why did you know if something goes south, they're going to go, why did you hire this cut rate law firm rather than the guys that charge three or four times as much? They've got a better reputation. They should be able to handle the work. And that's, I mean, your economic theory works because there's economic value attached to that reputation and attached to the use of that reputation. But it undercuts the efficient delivery of legal services because you're not being efficient in that regard.
What you're sort of saying without saying it is that reputation will work in the courtroom and that the judges, that it's not equal.
Well, it's not reputation in the courtroom. It's reputation in the marketplace. It's reputation in the organization. You're going to get, if you go in and pick a low-cost litigation firm, for example, in litigation, and you're the general counsel, and something bad happens, you are going to be sat down and said, why didn't you go with this outfit that charges five times as much? And a defense that they're not any better than the cut rate firm is not going to hack it. So you want the white shoe firm, because if something goes south,
I was on the board for 6 years, Lou.
Yeah,
but the underlying assumption is that
yes,
the firm that charges a lot more because they have much more power in the system. In the system, people think is not straight.
They're a safer choice. Well, reputation-wise, and everything.
I understand
else.
That, but the reason why, where was Jim Thompson? What's the name of his firm here? He was a big rainmaker.
Was he with Jenner?
No, that was
Kirkland.
No, it was.
I think it was Kirkland. Yeah.
So the idea
good
is
good firm. Good firm, by the way.
Okay, but the idea in most people's mind is the reason why somebody from there is worth four times. I won't say you because your firm's pretty good. Is that if the two of you are standing in front of a judge, the judge is going to go with him unless you really kick his ass. Everybody thinks the whole system is rigged that way, and that's why.
I have not run into that directly from clients, but I'm sure there are people that think that way.
Okay. Well, I know in the arbitration, this is a real quick story because I want to get, in the arbitration system here, there's a couple firms that really dominate it, and they if there was capital punishment here, maybe they should go there, because I've testified in front of these people a few times. But the people who are picked as arbitrators, they so dominate the area that if you give them a bad decision, you're probably not going to get picked again, because they won't pick you. I mean, that so the system ends up, could I write a paper saying this is why it's rigged? I can't say that, but I know it is. This is how people work.
In any event, my point is that there, in this professional services area, there are forces that drive you against going to the lowest common denominator. But I will also say, to go back to our original discussion topic, that artificial intelligence is going to cut a swath through the legal profession, through the consulting profession, that you won't be able to imagine, and sooner than you think.
Well, I mean, it's sort of no different, Lou, than every person having a secretary, and now people just hack away on a computer by themselves. Same thing.
It's not quite the same thing, but it's comparable.
It's the next iteration. But now the question is, what did we lose in efficiency by having these people that, oh no, we don't need them anymore? I mean, this is what I have no answers for this, Lou. I just sort of asked the question. I read it an article a while back. I spent a long time on this article. He contrasted the Speaker of the House in 1958, 63, somewhere in there, and how many people he had working for him, who were the people, and it was just a slew of 35 to 50-year-old ladies who came in and typed all this crap, used mimeograph machines, everybody knows what those things are, and how many bills per year those guys put out. And you contrast it now, there's like three times as many people work there. They got more computer capacity than God. Their production isn't any better. Now, whether it's superior, or somehow or another, we should be doing a lot better on this, is what I'm talking about.
I mean, yeah, let me tell you where I think one of the big pushes will be, and that's for purposes of delivery of professional services, it's going to be in the insurance market. Because what we're seeing in you know, business insurance, the business insurance world, is a push by the insurers to say, we don't want to pay for X number of hours on this project, this memo, this motion.
By the way, Tim Thompson was Winston and Strawn.
Winston Strawn, thank you. That's right. Kirkland didn't sound quite right. Anyway, we're not gonna pay for X number of hours to accomplish this project anymore. We're not gonna pay this amount for this level of work. You can give this to an AI system, and it will give you a comparable product, or at least a product that will focus your efforts, and will make you more productive. So we're not gonna pay that anymore. And to the extent that you have insurers that are now, you know, cross-checking every entry on a timesheet or every entry on a balance sheet and looking at it and using AI to do it, I think you're going to see insurance companies just basically say, we're not paying for the level of professional oversight that is a function of our insurance coverage. We're going to push all of that, or as much of that as we think we reasonably can, to an artificial intelligence system that will should be giving you, you know, Attorney Michaels, should be giving you a pretty good approximation of what a motion, the research, the memo should look like, and it'll do it in 10 minutes versus 2 hours.
Well, okay, I'm not, the only thing I'm kind of pushing back here a little bit, because, you know, I listen to everybody on the show, you for sure, and the computer guys tell me that it's not as revolution. It's a tremendous advance, but it's not as revolutionary as you think. Because years ago, instead of having a huge stack of a billion documents in the room, people start scanning all those documents, right? And how many, 10 years ago, I could search for, in a million documents, I could search for anything having to do with Jim Lawler. And the computer would tell me, well, that's AI. That was like the first
iteration.
It's
a rudimentary AI system.
Yeah. So yep. I'm saying, we continue to advance every day, but the idea is, it's like, for how many years that every other word on national TV was the cloud. Well, what's the cloud? Cloud is having people having computer capacity outside their place that they can access when they need it, storage or otherwise. Okay, when that became available, everybody didn't have to buy as many computers because you could, on your busy times of the year, access other people. That was, it became whatever you want to call it, you know, something that everybody could buy. Kevin used to talk about Better World Books. They were doing that 5 years before everybody called it the cloud. You know, all I'm saying is, there it's not like there aren't enough jobs in this country that we need to have.
Oh, no, and so, but what's ironic to me is that certain types of positions are going to become extremely valuable.
Yep.
Like a chef. Because you're not going to high-end chef, not fast food cooking, but high-end restaurant.
How about a breakfast chef that does 30 omelets an hour, and the omelets are now $18 a throw?
That's pretty valuable.
And some people think he should be making minimum wage. I don't know about that.
Well, but again, if you're looking for and you're seeing this. I mean, there's several variations on this. The whole bespoke tailoring industry, for example, yep, is driven by AI. But at some point, you're going to have, you know, the status of having your suit, your shoes, given to you or made for you by a human being is going to be a big deal. The pushback against the digital watch craze, I don't know if you're aware of this, but you know, the smartwatches are everywhere. But you're seeing a pushback now in certain circles that, you know, the real style choice is an analog watch.
Oh yeah.
A high-end analog watch, like a Rolex or
Louis, your Rolexes Tourbillon. Are still in style.
Very much. Because and the whole point is, hey, I don't need to have a smartwatch. I don't need to have something on my wrist telling me, you know, everything my phone's telling me. I'm secure enough that I can have an analog watch, so I don't have to be plugged in all the time.
Let me just maybe end this. We'll flip the subject here because I got a bunch of sports stuff, and we got to talk about Iran, of course. The only thing I'm saying, Lou, is if you walked into a real serious labor economics course or anything to do with economic history, if I were to say to you, here's the problem, young Lou. We have this industry, they make pickup trucks. And we need 60 hours of people to do this pickup truck. And the guys make $20 an hour, or 30, but whatever it was back in those days. And we're going to have these machines come in. They're going to cost a little bit. Of course, we'll tell you how much they're going to cost. And we're going to say, now we're going to be down in 10 years, we're going to be down to $40 an hour, which means we don't have to pay vacations, we don't have to pay all the other kind of stuff that goes with the stuff. And the trucks are $20,000. Explain what the future is going to look like in, you know, taking inflation out of it, which you can't do these days because inflation's all over the place. The A paper would be the person on the line is now going to be more valuable because all the little crap he had to do, he doesn't do. He's going to make some of his repetitive stuff's going to be done by the machine, which he maintains and makes sure he does it right. He's going to be making 40% more. The company's going to be making X. And oh, by the way, the price of the pickup truck is probably now 18 instead of 20. Well, I'm just saying, none of that has happened.
Yeah.
You know, and the question is, why? And I don't know the answer, but I'm telling you, it's not the way it was drawn up on the blackboard.
Got it.
And I don't know why. I mean, I just, some of it has to do with the people up top thinking it's all theirs. Some of it has to do with, I mean, nobody wants to pay a dividend. Nobody wants, or the investors should make more. The investors don't make any more. I mean, maybe the stock went up. Maybe it didn't, but dividends aren't that much higher. I mean, it's all, and this is, I think, the fear that you have inside of people. And you hear, I know you're a pretty observant dude. I don't know what you creatures on this show have changed my whole personality. Everywhere I go now, I think there's a story, and not just the other day. As I mentioned yesterday, I'm getting my alignment done. So I'm sitting there waiting for a half hour, and these three, I'm going to say old ladies, I'm going to say two were probably 80, and one was maybe 75. They sit down next to me, two black, one white, and all of a sudden, they got all these, you know, commercials and all the news. They got, you know, daytime TV is something I never watch, and it's always astounding to me. And they come out there, and somebody starts talking about how much the Iran war is costing per day. Immediately, these three people, it's like you hit them with a, you know, some kind of a dart of energy. All three of them go, what in the hell are we doing over there? We got two presidents in a row telling me how we're going to drop my prescription drug stuff. I can't afford it. I'm going broke, and nobody does anything there. And yet here we're firing missiles at people we don't even know who the hell they are. I mean, it is astounding how people react to what's going on, and how no matter what, nothing ever seems to get to me. But no matter what situation you're in, by the way, the thing about these betting places, there's a guy downstairs, well, there's a bunch of guys downstairs in the bar downstairs, talking to this guy, and he somehow it got to be this guy making his bet, like we started the conversation today. The guy says to me, you know, I got two buddies that live in Washington. This guy's he's a blue-collar guy of some kind. And he's like, I got two buddies. They're in a bar in Washington. They called me late that night and said, we're going to blast Iran tomorrow. He goes, they all know it. I know it. He goes, these things aren't kept at all. And I said, how did somebody get a bet down on it? I said, I have no idea. How scary is that?
Yeah, it's probably had a link to a pizza delivery place outside the Pentagon.
Maybe something. Hey, what the guy from the huge trade to Baltimore, and the guy didn't pass the physical. What happens there?
Max Crosby. Pretty much what you see. The trade falls through. Both sides go back to you know their former positions. That's a term precedent in the contract, and the trade agreement. I can't remember exactly what the problem was, but the passing of the physical is a huge issue, and in fact there've been a number of grievances filed within the league in past years over accusations that teams are gaming their medical exam because you know they didn't want to do the deal. They agreed to it and then wanted to back out of it.
My question. I mean, what? I'll pick something. They say, well, he had an ankle sprain in the last game. Our guys say, you know, he's good to go, training camp. And there's a guy looks at an app. He might miss two games. Now, is that enough to screw the whole deal?
No, because it's a pass fail kind of thing. It's not a. You don't look at it from the perspective of, how many games is he going to miss or whatever. You look at it from the perspective of can he safely perform at whatever level we expect him to perform, commensurate with the terms of the contract. So it sort of slides, or it can slide. Teams would be willing to take a risk on a guy that you're not paying. You know, $200 million in a contract, and they might be willing to say, okay, fine, he's not 100%, but we're not paying him X, so he's cleared. We'll take him, and he'll pass the physical or he'll pass the medical. If you're paying $200 million for a player, we expect him to be able to step out on the field right away. And if he can't do that, then we're voiding the deal.
Were you surprised when the people from the Packers when they snagged the guy from Dallas, they traded for him. Did they trade for him or didn't he have back problems or something? He actually missed the whole exhibition. And he ended up hurting his knee or something.
Micah Parsons, yes.
Parsons. Now, could they have examined him and said, "Man, we don't want him"?
Yes.
But it's a flat out, we don't want him. There's no.
But it's got to be. But it's up. It's got to be up front. Once you sign it, I mean, it's not like you. Excuse me. It's not like you can sign the guy and then he blows his knee out or has some kind of incipient back problem two weeks into the contract. You can't go back to the Cowboys and say, "Hey, we're voiding this. You know, take him back." Doesn't work that way.
Well, you can examine him and say you think his back's going to be fine. Might be fine at $2 million a year, but it's not fine for $20 million a year.
That's what I just said. You're willing to accept a certain level of uncertainty. As long as you're not spending gigantic amounts of money.
How often does that happen? Because all these guys, I mean, when you're talking about...
It's unusual.
But, I mean, after I guess my question is a one you can't answer, but after 5 years in the league, who walks in and has the body of a 20-year-old that never played football?
Nobody. But you know, they can look at the injuries that you've got and say, okay, he can perform, he should be able to perform at this level. Or he's not. We don't expect, based on the surgery, based on the the MRI, based on whatever, we don't expect there to be. There's no obvious signs of a limitation. Now, what's going on in his head is another matter. But we don't see any signs of a physical limitation, and then that he'll pass the medical.
There's a huge hue and cry lately here about the amount of concussions in sports. One of the universities here must have just done a big study. Correct me if I'm wrong. The single biggest concussions in sports now are young girls in soccer getting whacked with the ball and head and banging.
I don't know if it's the single biggest, but it's definitely the soccer heading thing has been known for at least 10 years. When the NFL concussion protocol started rolling out, you started seeing pushes in the soccer leagues in FIBA and the rest of them. To say, wait a minute, we've got the same issue. Now they have, the Europeans have not, to my knowledge, stepped up on this. There is no concussion protocol in soccer. There is no assessment or measurement of cognitive functions in soccer that I'm aware of. And I think about six months ago to a year ago, I reported here that there was a case going in Ireland over rugby. And it was the Irish Rugby League, and a bunch of the players had come together to try to force some kind of a settlement or litigation over the fact that they were getting head injuries, and that they needed to that there needed to be some kind of compensation or dispensation for this within the rugby union rules, and it fell apart in court. For the same reason that the NFL concussion issue would have fallen apart in court, because the causation wasn't clear. Now, and you and I had a long discussion about this at the time. I don't know if you recall it, but
yep.
The point I was making was there was a real good reason why that NFL concussion settlement was settled, and a huge part of it revolved around causation, because it was impossible to draw a line to delineate where. You know, the concussions from college football, from high school football, from peewee football started, and where the concussion or ended, and where the concussions from NFL football began. And so any player coming in with CTE and saying this is the result of my NFL time, it was going to have a hell of a time showing that the NFL was even, you know, responsible in a major way.
Well, one of my have I mentioned this problems. When we had that discussion, one of my an acquaintance, pretty good friend, I was better friends with his brother who joined the Army because he's played basketball with him all the time. But a guy I've gone skiing with, a trader down here, nice guy. There's a big family, and one of the brothers blew himself away, right? And it turns out the family's like, you know, this guy hasn't been right for years. They sent his brain out to, you know, wherever the hell you sent it. And they came back, and sure enough, he was loaded with the, what is it, DTE or whatever?
CTE, yep.
And, well, the guy played football. I'm not sure if he played for Evergreen Park or Brother Rice, one of the two. He probably played grammar school ball somewhere. Then he went to Penn, of all places. You know, and Penn, you know, they got a football team, but it's not like they're, you know, they're Ohio State, where you think is like a factory. But he was legally, like you say, he was up Bleep Creek without a paddle. It must have been in high school. Oh, no, it must have been in grammar school. I mean, he got nowhere, just like I just said. So it's not like you're saying something wrong here, buddy. But it's true. Everybody says, "Oh no, couldn't have been us."
I mean, that delineated that. That's why I said when the NFL concussion settlement came down and the protocols came down, and people were screaming, "This is so outrageous! Why did they take the settlement?" I said because there were legitimate defenses that the NFL had from a in court that would have made it very, very difficult for anybody to get any money. For decades.
Well, this is how sometimes, Lou, and I'm not saying he did this because he's been dead for a while. I know his son, nice guy. Matter of fact, I knew him. I'm talking about George Conner, who played for, he went to Holy Cross, then he joined the Army, and then he got recruited to Notre Dame. So he was an All-American. I think he was, I'm not sure if he's a Heisman Trophy winner, but he was a huge sign for the Bears, and he played, I think he's in the NFL Hall of Fame. I talked to him, just a regular guy from south side of Chicago. And he told me he had 22 surgeries after he left football, none of which were paid for by the Bears or Notre Dame or Holy Cross, for that matter. And I get it. A smart attorney like you are would say, not our job at Notre Dame. Looks to me like that happened at lacrosse. Or the Bears say, looks to me like that was a nagging injury from Notre Dame and we somehow missed the 10 years he was playing here. I mean, I get it. But the simple fact is, out of those three, somebody should be ponying up, and not you and me. I guess is my point.
Agreed. And maybe, this may be a function of NIL, that as we move toward a quasi-employment status for college athletes, we put into place some kind of quasi-workers' compensation system that would pick up for their injuries, and in addition to paying into this NIL pot that the colleges are paying into, they would pay into an injury pot, an insurance pot that would cover these guys for what happens to them, and it wouldn't necessarily have to attach immediately. It would attach like the NFL's does down, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the road.
But now you have more experience with these young, bulletproof, super hormonal creatures. Do you think for a second that one of the guys at, I'll say at Notre Dame or Michigan, Ohio State, that's getting the $3 million a year, you could say, well, by the way, we're taking $100,000 and we're putting it in a workman's comp thing? Do you think any of these guys want to do that?
Hell no.
No.
I mean, we saw this. We saw this when the fight over two CBAs ago, collective bargaining agreements ago, when the NFL Players Association came in and said, look, we've boosted your benefits package dramatically so that, and have put insurance policies in place, we're funding health insurance and investment funds that are going to attach to you after you turn 40. And the general reaction of the players was, I want my money now, man.
Well, yeah, I'll take care of it.
I don't care.
Well, you know, when you talk about my niece had a pretty nasty, and a couple of her friends did too, and playing, she still plays soccer, but I think her situation, somebody was just coming around and some pretty strong girl just kicked the ball and went the wrong direction right to her head. It wasn't like she headed anybody or did anything. It was just, I mean, that ball's heavy enough where if you get whacked by it, you could get a concussion, I believe, right?
Yes.
So I think some of it is just people getting bonked. But anyway, it's all these things. Lou, yesterday, just so you know, yesterday I was ranting earlier about being brainwashed. Yesterday was kind of a new low in the CPI number. Normally, if the government's lying to you, they kind of just lie to you. They don't give you the detail. Yesterday, the CPI thing comes out. They give you the unadjusted number, which is 0.5% on a month. Then they give you the adjusted number. It's 0.2. It's not like they only gave you the 0.2 and you had to suspect they were cheating. They gave you both numbers. And they last month was the same way. The unadjusted was 0.4, and I think the adjusted was 0.2. So in the last 2 months, if you took the unadjusted number, we're talking about an inflation rate of pushing 6%, 5.5, not 2.4. And yet every news show, every radio thing, inflation came in tame at 2.4. No, it didn't. In the line where they had motor fuel was up 1.7, and they adjusted it down to like 0.3 or 0.5. I mean, this is before the war started. It was already going up. Of course, it had been going down before that. I get it. But look, they're giving you the numbers and they're telling you how to interpret them, and people do. I mean, how can we be this stupid? Can anybody?
I'm going to leave you with this. I think it's a quote by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who said that the essence of communism, or any dictatorship, is that they lie to you. You know they're lying. They know you know they're lying. You yeah. know that they know that they, you know they're lying. That's what I'm going to leave you with.
But at least they're not dumb enough to actually give you the real number.
Well, it's effectively they are giving you the real number because they know.
Yeah.
Everybody knows they're lying to you. So anyway,
you get to the same place. Are you guys getting any more snow? Well, I hear about the whole place is drying out.
Another dry week here. So take care. We're gonna batten down the hatches for fire danger today, and you guys try to avoid those nasty thunderstorms that I saw roll through.
Yeah, boy, the thing in Kankakee the other night was bizarre.
Yep.
Anyway, S&P futures down 40, NASDAQ futures down 144. Do we have our guys?
You have me here.
How are you, bud?
Well, I'm suffering with the spring allergies, but I think I'll be able to make it through.
Well, you can always fly to somewhere where it's still winter, and you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, I for a while I thought about moving to New Mexico because while I was there, I realized that my asthma cleared up and I could breathe again. But anyway, then I came to my senses.
Well, you know when you get older, and we were young at one point, and we had to listen to old people, right? One of our biggest clients, and someday I'll tell you about this guy, and we have some time, owned all his stuff out in Arizona, right? nothing but dough, nice guy. Allegedly, I was accused of being the only Democrat ever allowed in his house. but he liked me. We got along pretty real well. And anyway, but he was telling me that one of the things you have to worry about out there is the dryness. And he goes, you see that beautiful swimming pool? And I go, yeah. He goes, I haven't been in it in 10 years. I go, why? He goes, if I stick my feet in there, an hour later, I got to start putting lotion on. He says, you can't, wherever you is at, something's going to get you.
I actually was in Tempe one time for a conference, and I was constantly having nosebleeds because it was so dry You know, I thought I was on the set of the movie Dune, where they had those sort of humidifier things in their nostrils spraying water, because I said it was out. It was something else. It was, yeah, the dryness was too much.
Well, the people in Vegas, you know, we had all the shows out there and stuff. I mean, a lot of people couldn't sing because it was, throat was, so they actually, some ingenious dude or dudette invented a microphone where the thing actually sprays out a little mist. So if you're at the microphone, you can actually get some moisture on your vocal cords.
I think Andy's got one of those microphones.
Andy seems to be a guy who's got like just about everything. Let's talk about him now that he's here. Andy, how are you, bud?
Doing good, and the mic is working today.
Well, there you go. So what do we think about? Are we saying Andrew's got an '82 Toyota Corolla he drives up to Washington in or something? What did you say he had?
Oh, I've had those type of cars for many years, but not now. I used to buy cars when I was a newspaper reporter at gas stations, because the thought is, at some point, people have a jalopy, and they hear the bill, and they walk away, and the gas station guys would work on it. I'd go and buy it for $40 or $50, try to get 7 or 8 months out of it.
Well, my grandfather, boy, talking Jose, he extended family's in Columbus, Ohio, right? So once in a while they would hop in the old junk and drive. I think on two occasions he showed up with a car different than the one he left in. He'd be on the side of the road, and the farmer, they're all like Model A's or something. The farmer goes, well, mine's running, I can fix yours, and he'd give him like $50 and trade cars and go onward. I got a question for you guys. The more I dig into this, immigrants are all wrong, or there are problems with this country and all this stuff. I don't know if you guys listened last Friday's show that Carl has been digging through these numbers, talking about the 2 million people that supposedly got here that shouldn't have been, and now we all kicked them all out and everything. He said the numbers don't show anything like that, either on the way in or the way out. So I don't know what that means necessarily, other than his conclusion was they're lying to us. But I guess, which kind of is the CPI number yesterday, and we have this thing with Iran, which I got to get into a little bit. On the one hand, we got a guy saying the thing's going to be over tomorrow, and now they're going to kick 172 million barrels out of 400 and some that we have in this reserve, which is essentially 35-40%. It can maximum out of there is about 4 million a day. So he's talking about a 4 month, but I guess the normal draw is about 2 million a day. We're talking about a 4 month draw on this thing, draining us down to where we don't have much left. How does that coincide with the war's going to be over like tomorrow? That's those speeches. I mean, what are we doing here? Does anybody know?
I would just say that I think the strategic petroleum reserves are already depleted. When Biden left office, they weren't at 100%, but now they're apparently, during Trump's first term, they're down to like 30 or 40%. So we don't really have that much available there. And I think, based on what that bizarre speech Trump gave last night in Kentucky.
Well, I didn't hear that one. What did he say?
He was all over the map, and then dancing to the YMCA,
Oh, God.
Talking about how prices were coming down, and he got nothing but groans from, and these were supposed to be dedicated Trumpers that waited in line. It was really hot there, apparently. Trump was sweating. He was talking about, oh, prices are coming down, and he started talking about the war, and he got nothing but groans from this audience. You can imagine. He went to the district of this guy, Thomas Massie, which is over in western Kentucky, and he's, and, you know, he's saying, you got to get rid of this guy, because Massey's one of the few Republicans that want full disclosure of the Epstein files. And he made a total fool out of himself in front of people that I would have probably at one time classified as fools themselves. But even they, I think, figured out this guy's a carnival barker.
I don't think, even though we may be, what was this, a TV show? Well, there's a guy up at, back when I first had trading in futures, was the Kansas City Value Line. There was a big table of all these guys back when you could smoke up there. If you ever want to see a group of guys, you could just sit there and be entertained. All day. These guys were all nuts. They'd all die for the same phone because nobody had a cell phone. There's like four phones in the middle of the table. And one of the guys one day goes, "We might be pigeons, but we're not fish." So, I mean, even some of the people you think are, I won't say dumb, are not as informed, at some point they get a little more informed. I mean, we're not as dumb as they think we are, I guess is my point. I hope. I don't know, Andrew, if you'd like to speak to that, but I don't think we're as dumb as they think we are.
Here's a thought. I mean, you go all the way back to not just Mark Twain's time a century and a half ago, but even before then, you have the rural people are very suspicious of the city slicker. And, you know, with good reason, but, you know, the card sharp, I mentioned Mark Twain because he wrote about it, but there's a tradition wariness. And yet the irony is, maybe thanks to Trump's TV show, The Apprentice, which is fake reality show, he's the ultimate city slicker who's endeared himself to the rural areas. But I think a lot of them are starting to get the message. But it's quite ironic because in New York, for example, and I think we've talked about it on the show, when he announced his campaign, even the Murdoch tabloid, the New York Post, had all kinds of jokes at his expense. And yet, until recently, he's kept up his popularity among areas where there's a tradition of fear and resent the city slicker.
Well, I think that this is going to sound, I'm not tying the two together, I'm not doing anything, but I, for whatever reason, I've gotten myself involved. I haven't done it much lately, but for a while I was kind of enthralled by some of the dictators, you know, in the 30s and 40s. And obviously, you guys have done more research and what economic conditions forced them to come out and so forth. And so the one you can get the most on, it's easier to get stuff on Hitler than Mussolini, although Mussolini probably was even more innovative in a lot of ways than Hitler, but I just don't seem to find the history in front of me about him. But you look at Hitler, there's amazing similarities in the sense that he was terrific on radio, much like Roosevelt, in terms of he did a radio thing. His way of captivating people was, I saw a film of him walking in, those guys, didn't they have the world's greatest uniforms? He walks in and there's this guy in a hospital bed. Guys, you wouldn't want to bend this guy. He was in, I don't know if he was in a submarine plant or a munitions plant that blew up or something. The guy's burned over God knows percent of his body, and he's sitting there going, if it was one of us, we just want somebody to put a bullet in our head, right? The guy's laying there, and Hitler comes in to see him in this incredible white outfit. And the guy sees Hitler, he tries to salute, and Hitler immediately, without any hesitation, without like grabbing a glove or anything, grabs the guy gently by the hand, puts his hand down, and he salutes the guy. And I'm sitting there going, Bill Clinton on his best day could have done a performance like that. And the guy was incredible in the sense that he knew what people were. You can't walk home. There's a bunch of losers in the street. I'll take the losers in the street out of there. And he did. You know, now, granted, he was an animal inside, but I mean, the part that Democrats, I think, don't get is a lot of the stuff that Trump made it into office was absolutely true. You look at a city like Chicago or some places, we got 500 murders, and the next year there's 490, and the mayor's, and Trump says, this is insane. You're not protected. These people aren't doing their job. I'm gonna stop this for you. People want to hear that. The idea that all of a sudden the money is going to the chief executives. Now, why did we believe Trump on this? People said, you're not getting your fair share. I'm going to make sure that your taxes are going down. Well, they went down a little bit, but not enough. I mean, the fact is, he hasn't come through. But the messages, and he got Hispanic people to vote for him by saying other Hispanic people that Biden left over the border are getting ahead of them in the line for being citizens. None of it was true, but we're talking to a group of people that for some reason, for year after year after year, it's harder as hell to become a citizen here, even though you've been here 25 years. So the guy knew the keys. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, that's right. You know, I was once invited to speak at the what's now State Archives. It was at the Nuremberg Stadium where Hitler used to give those massive speeches before those rallies, thousands of people. And you mentioned him being on radio. I found out there that Hitler and Goebbels arranged to provide something called the Volksempfänger. This was a radio receiver that was given free to every household in Germany. So you would turn it on and you would hear nothing but Hitler's speeches and other propaganda. You couldn't change it to like, well, I want to listen to the BBC now. Nuh-uh. It was only on the dedicated frequencies that Hitler and the Nazis broadcast on. And think about that, and think about people that keep Fox News on all day long.
Well, I got one worse for you. I know a couple of people that the TV only seems to work for Newsmax, which makes Fox News look liberal.
Yes, right.
You ever listen to that thing?
Oh, yeah, and then there's One American News out of San Diego, and I mean, that's like, that makes Newsmax look like, the BBC. I mean, it's...
Well, for a quick review of this Strategic Petroleum Reserve, we went from, this thing started way the hell back where in the early 80s, right? Now, in the early 80s, you guys know this better than me. Weren't we only producing about 50% of our oil, and we were importing like 50% or something? So the idea of having a strategic petroleum reserve, I guess, made a lot of sense, okay? And we're roughly 500,000 barrels all the way. I'm fast forward to 85, they're 464 million. Now, 86, they're 507. 88, 540. Well, we get up to, and it hangs in the high fives, really all the way to the mid-90s. Well, maybe even further than that. I'm going to say the 90, if we finally crossed, we're 95 here, and it's 581, 96, 585. So that seems to be some number, even though there was never, I don't think, a mandated number by anybody. Seemingly, everybody seemed happy in the high fives. And we're importing about, I think, 40% of our oil in those days, until somebody decided to find fracking, right? So then we continue. We're still in the high fives in 2003. Then in the Obama administration, for whatever reason, we start to creep up. 603, 608, I'm talking about months here. And I don't know why they decided to go from the high fives, which it had been for like a decade and a half. We get up to 659, 669, 700 in 2005, which is Obama years, correct? See, was he? No, that was Bush years.
Bush. Yeah.
Okay, so Bush, we get to 700, and we hang in the high sixes. Really, 2000. When did Obama come in? 2000 and.
He came in January of 2009.
Okay, so we're at 688, in January. Let's see, 7:01 in January of 09. All right, so we're up from the high fives to the very low sevens. And during Obama's tenure, we pretty much hang there. And when he gets out of there, which would have been, what, 2012? He was gone and Trump came in?
January 13th,
okay,
right.
So we're up to, he's right back at this, we're right about 700. So he topped out at 726 in May of 2011. But still, during this whole period now, we're producing more and more of our own stuff. So this level, I don't think you guys know better than me that there never was a congressional mandate. Oh man, we got to have 700 million in there, because I don't think anybody ever said that. It was just a number. So then,
is an international agreement that I guess can be voided or ignored, but you have a 90-day supply.
All right, so we do 20 million barrels a day. 20 goes into 750. What is that? That doesn't make, that's 90, isn't it? And we're more like 60 days. Am I right? 20 goes under 600.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're, and then when Biden during the COVID or whatever mess was there, he started draining it down, and Trump was all pissed off, right? So we got down in 2023 down to like 345, and then we started to go back up again. So by the time Trump came in January of 2025, where are we? We're up to 395. Now it's continued to creep up a little since Trump has been there in the last year. So we're at 415. But my question to you guys is, we now import allegedly nothing. We produce as much as we... So is 415 as good a number now as 600 was 20 years ago? I mean, I don't know, man. That's what I'm asking. I mean, what should the number be? Does anybody even know?
Well, then there's Andy mentioned the international agreement, that there's something called the International Energy Agency, which I believe is at least the G7 countries. A lot of the strategic reserve stockpiling is done in concert with them, but under Trump, I don't know. That may be all.
Well, no, that's what happened. That's
the
what
window too.
No, that's what happened yesterday. Those are the guys that said worldwide they're going to pump out like 400 and some million barrels, 500, and of that, 172 are going to be us. So yeah, there's all kinds of other people doing this too. It is those guys.
Right.
It's the IEA, whoever they are.
IEA, right? Yeah. Very little known. International organization.
But I mean, we do 20 million barrels of something a day, and if you're talking about a drain rate of somewhere between 2 and 4, I got to believe that it'd take a while to get to 4, so say 2, we're talking what, 10% of what we use, and we can drain out, drain out what, 200 days if we had to. Well, that's not that long when wars come.
No.
So I don't know, Andrew. What does this even do? Is this, how do you say?
Well, it provides temporary confidence to people who are fearful, worried, concerned. But ultimately, what's the end game in Iran is the problem, and. You talked earlier in the show about different messages. Well, part of it is different messages for different audiences, but also different people in the administration who are supposed to be out there talking as if they know what they're talking about. But until they hear from President Trump on his often changeable directions, they're left out there to dry on the Sunday TV shows and their own press conferences because he might contradict what they're saying.
Secretary of the Interior was on CNBC yesterday, and I didn't even know who the guy was, but the speech, every question is under President Trump. The guy must have mentioned President Trump 35 times in his 3-minute spot there. Is this something they have to do?
Of course they do.
But
now, let me think how to pronounce his name. But his name is Doug Bergeron.
Bergum, from Bergum. The former governor of North Dakota.
Yeah, and so he made a lot of money in the high tech, but because that state is now associated with energy, he's supposed to be a big expert, and he's Secretary of the Interior, so he's supposed to know. But just last night, there was an article in the kind of D.C. trade publication Politico that says he and the Energy Secretary, Chris Wright, are under a lot of scrutiny now because they're supposed to have solutions, but they don't necessarily have solutions, I guess is the gist of it.
Do they still, I know you guys aren't, although you always surprise me with your knowledge and intelligence, do they still have the game in place that if you get a cabinet level office, that none of these guys still, they trade all the time, so I don't know if it's still there, but it used to be you could get rid of the stock in the company that you went there and not pay taxes on it, either to the next generation or something. You got a huge tax dodge. That's why Arthur Levitt became SEC chairman, is because he was Duke Chapman, who was the chairman of the CBU. I think he was his roommate or something in law school. And Duke one night, after a few cocktails, tells Dr. J and me, you know why these guys become cabinet level? And Jen and I go, I have no idea. He goes, you get a tax dodge. They require you, which I don't think they do anymore, they require you to sell your stock in like the company you came from. And he was from DLJ, Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette. He gets to sell that stock. And I don't think it's a total freebie on the taxes, but you jump a generation or something. That's probably why the guy from the Chessie system came in. Was he Trump's transportation guy his first term, or was it him, or one of those guys? That those guys get to sell their stock. Can they still do that? Do you have any idea?
Well, it sounds like something that was an ethics requirement, but ethics today is out the window. Now we know that, you know, Trump and his cabinet and members of Congress, they're trading stock and buying and selling crypto till the cows come home. And you mentioned this guy Berga mentioning Trump's name all the time. It's so bad that Trump sent black Florsheim shoes to every one of his male cabinet members and other senior officials at the White House and expected them to wear these black Florsheim shoes, which they did, except in the case of Marco Rubio, the shoes that he was sent were two sizes too big for his feet, and some enterprising photographer the other day took a photo of his shoes.
God.
And you can see this space between his heel and the shoe, the back of the shoe. And I remember the debate where they were talking about little hands. Trump said, Marco, he's got little hands. Well, now it's Marco's got little feet.
Well, you know what he really meant with the little hands piece?
Oh, yes. We know.
Yeah, we all know.
But if only Marco had spoken to the Stormy Daniels, he could have had a good comeback.
Did you catch this thing on CNBC yesterday? The one thing that's kind of, and we're kind of jumping around, but it's sort of the same topic. This guy, somehow or another, I don't know, one of you guys, sing me on some article regarding who would, because, you know, the dude in Iran is 86 years old, the guy we knocked off.
Yeah.
You know, who's going to succeed him? And evidently, you had to be like a you had to be a graduate of this, you know, cleric school, for lack of a better term. And they said a lot of people would like his kid get in there because he's hard right, he's this and the other thing. But unless there's a crisis, they won't essentially waive the part that he has to be a full blown mule or whatever he got to be. Of course, we now created the crisis. We and right. Netanyahu. So now the guy is in. And they claim not only was his father, but was it his mother-in-law, his sister,
his mother,
all kinds of people.
And I think his wife.
Yeah, all got knocked off in this thing. So, but anyway, how does this sound about how the world politics? He reportedly has an international property empire. Despite being an image of religious piety and simplicity in Iran, he owns a property empire from the Middle East to Europe worth hundreds of millions, according to a year-long investigation by Bloomberg. He owns a bunch of hotels.
You know, they all have over the years. I remember there was the Ayatollah who came in, one of the guys after Khomeini, this guy Rafsanjani. I think he was one of the mullahs, became president of Iran. And he basically owned the pistachio monopoly in Iran.
Really?
And even at the height of hostilities, you know, not full-blown war between Iran and Israel. I was in Israel in the 90s, and I went to the market in Tel Aviv, and the person showing me around pointed to those pistachios. And she said, you know where they're from? I said, no. She says, we buy them from Iran, not directly, but through the Turks. But they're Iranian pistachios. And I said, well, you're making Rafsanjani wealthy. She says, yeah. And this is in the 90s. And she said, she was a newspaper editor. And she says, no, we can't get anybody here to publish this, that we're helping to make Rafsanjani wealthy.
You guys must know where these places are. His investments include luxury homes on the Bishop's Avenue in London. What is that? More commonly known as Billionaire's Road.
Yeah, Bishop's Gate. It's very, very highfalutin area in London.
Instead of the guy relaxing on whatever island he controls, we've made him a very angry orphan.
Yeah, I mean, many of his assets are not in his own name, duh. But instead held through a web of intermediaries, offshore companies, and business associates. God.
Sounds like Epstein.
Yeah. It was one of them here. One of his associates appeared to be this guy, Wayne Matt. Oh, no.
I was
there, and there are some photos of me being introduced to Iranian audiences to speak, where the mullah was giving me, you know, the peck on each cheek. And,
oh, God.
You know, I'm from Jersey, and that used to mean something else if you got that kind of treatment from the wrong person.
what do you say we go to break here, guys? SP Futures down 42, and NASDAQ Futures down 150. Still not as much as we were lower last night, but lower than when we came in this morning. So we'll be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks,
stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now,
we're back. Hello, back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen, Jim on the board. SP Futures down 43, NASDAQ Futures down 158. The breaking news here appears to be that Energy Secretary Wright says U.S. not ready to escort tankers through the Strait of Hormuz. This is the same guy who said we escorted one the other day, then he took it off the website, right? But anyway, that's what's going on. Andrew and Wayne, when I get done with this, do you guys know anything about these Section 301 probes? Maybe we can talk about it afterward. Anyway, the S&P futures, like I said, down 43, NASDAQ down 154, Dow down 393. Individual stocks, Goldman Sachs down $16, that's a chunk. A Caterpillar down 759, American Express down 450, so everything in the Dow except CVX is red. CVX is the only thing I see here is red. Interest rates keep creeping up. 10 years up to 4.22. It was under 4 when this all started. So interest rates you would expect would be going down as you get a flight to quality in bonds. They actually are going the other way. I don't exactly know what that means. Just pointed out that that's what's happening. DAX down 82.4%, so not much. Puts you down 47.5. They're not, again, not that much. CAC around down 46.7%. Over in Asia, these guys obviously have been very volatile like we have. Nikkei's down 572. That's 1%. Hang Seng down 182.7%. Mainland China only down 4. So let's call that one flat. Bonds, 10 years up one basis point. Well, actually, it's up more than that. If you look at the stuff, it's actually trading at TNX. And we have oil, which despite pouring the stuff out of the reserves, which is going to take a little while, is up almost $6, 93.20. So the Strait of Hormuz problem continues to be much bigger weight on the oil market than the idea of pumping out oil from reserves. The gold is down 380, 51.75, still pretty high. It's right kind of unchanged. Silver's up $1.48, however, 87.02. Foreign exchange, the dollar is still pretty strong. The euro's down to 115.3. British pound down to 133. They were both higher. Crypto down 293, but still over 70,000, 73.38. Jimmy, quick traffic, weather, sports, and we'll get back to our guys.
Okay, on traffic, the inbound Kennedy is 35 from the Kennedy from Montrose. The inbound Edens is 53, so we have a backup starting to develop. Inbound Eisenhower is 46. The inbound Dan Ryan is 28. Quickly to sports, we had the NBA last night. I guess the big news was the Knicks beat the Jazz. The Bulls did not play. Let's take a quick look on the NHL.
Who cares about the Hawks? They suck.
Hawks didn't play. For weather, Phoenix right now is 60 degrees. It'll be sunny and a high of 92. In Chicago right now, it's 31, and we'll have a high of 47. Back to you, Chief.
Guys, before I forget, I don't know if you're watching the primary stuff here is next week. We've got Election Day and St. Patrick's Day, which I think should be enough to get anybody in jail if you're a politician. But anyway, it's St. Patrick's Day. We're supposed to be in a saloon, right? Not out voting, but hopefully we can do both. I had the misfortune of listening to a little. I've been watching some of these commercials, right? But the primaries, all the people running for Durbin's office and all these other places. And I know we've gone into a focus group world, right? Where we try and tell people what they tell us they want to hear. And this is, guys, I mean, we've been around a while, but unfortunately, that's the world we're in. I don't know when it all started. I think it started under Bill Clinton, but I'm not positive. But so I had the unfortunate spot to listen to all these in a row, all these Democratic people running for primaries. Did they all go to the same focus group? I mean, I've been in many of these things, and we did some of the stuff when I ran for the SIBO, so maybe I could pick it out more than a regular person, not an expert. But it seems like they all sound exactly the same. there's four things that is in every single one. One is that the person is going to fight, which leads me to believe that one of the criticisms is, I don't even know what my guy does. Doesn't look to me like he's done anything. So it's everybody's going to show how aggressive they're going to be. The word fight is in there probably five times. It's just like the interior guy talking about President Trump. The other is medical expenses are still front and center. Absolutely front and center. And nobody likes ICE. and nobody likes Trump. Those four things are in there. I mean, I fought against President Trump. I forced to get ICE out of your district. I have already done stuff at the state level to lower your prescription drug costs. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to fight going forward. Every single one, just put a different name on it, was the same commercial. Does that surprise you guys?
No. You know, there are training sessions for candidates, so they hear a lot of the same stuff. Just a personal opinion. Hope I don't offend people, but if you're looking for an issue to distinguish people, see who's most funded by the cryptocurrency interests, because that's one difference. And so in this primary season, you have Jesse Jackson's son is getting a lot of money, for example, from the crypto industry.
Well, the other kid got a chunk from the guy who's in jail.
That's the one, I think.
Well, he wasn't crypto. He was the a Bitcoin guy.
So are they going to fight those guys? And that's what pays for the focus groups and ads. And, you know, is that who's best going to represent the financial interests of the public? Is might be a legitimate question.
Well, what do you think the both of you guys, when somebody wins, and now somebody's running against a Republican, what do you think the message changes to? It won't be the same thing, I don't think. What do you think it changes to? It's got to come up a little bit than just that, I would hope.
Well, are they truly fight or not? Or are they go along to get along? Now, there are instances of people who would take the money and then double-cross the donors, but not that common.
No, it's not.
They're usually one-termers.
Well, the one guy gave, this kind of hits close to home, because we had Karen. You remember Bobby Rush's seat? Bobby Rush was there forever. And when he left, the guy, he drove to this thing we went to, this lady, Karen Reeves, and she, absolutely spectacular human being, just a real nice lady, and she adopted a blind kid. Talk about nice lady, and just, if you talk to her, you sit there and go, my God, why isn't this lady something? I mean, eyes lock on you, knows what you're talking about. Anyway, I was very, very, she came on the show a couple times, and it was a 10-person field running for Bobby Rush's spot. Well, at the last minute, the crypto guy gives Jesse's kid $1 million or thereabouts. So he was able to put this advertising out, and he ends up winning by not very much. And now the other kid who went to jail is running for another district. So I think, much as I think Jesse Jackson was a pretty good guy, I'm not sure I want his two offspring in two spots in the Congress. But anyway, that's just me. But so Durbin and these other guys that took money from this dude, when he got convicted, they all gave the money to a charity. Jesse's kid didn't. He kept it. I mean,
are you talking about Bankman-Fried?
Yeah. The guy from the Bahamas, where Ellie was.
Oh yeah, he's in the Hooskow now.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I've had some experience with running for office. I almost ran for the Virginia 8th District back in 2004, and you know, it's almost like if you like salami, you don't want to see how they make it, or sausage. I got to see how this game is played, and I was told basically to get donations from wealthy donors. Look, you've got to sign on to this, and this. Even if you don't agree with this, and this. And I got, you know, it was so frustrating. I just decided the minute you take money, you're forever obligated to follow the rules of the Federal Election Commission for any federal office. And I just said, look, this is a sink or swim type decision. I decided, no, I'm not going to go ahead with it because, you know, they can get you in trouble if you misspend a dime if they want to. So, but that's how the game is played.
Well, that's what Carol mentions on Friday, that he helped a friend of his get elected in a spot in Florida when he was down there. But he did all the accounting, you know, for the election, whatever you're talking about. He goes, it was a big job to make sure you did. Nothing was amiss, because if there is and they don't like you, all of a sudden...
Oh, boy. You're right.
You wouldn't think that the government would have their own secret police on people that get elected, but evidently they do. Huh?
Yep.
So, Andrew, what was I asked a question about the new thing on the tariffs, since the Supreme Court bailed the, you know, and by the way, I don't know, you guys got the thing I sent you yesterday. We're running through $1 trillion every 100 days now. That's kind of a lot. But evidently they're pushing forth all these Section 301 probes into all these countries on the Trade Act of 74. Do you guys know anything about that, or should we talk about it next week?
Let me jump in on that. After the Supreme Court threw out the emergency tariff regime, the president is so enthusiastic about tariffs that he's now figuring out Plan B. And that's to announce investigations of a number of major economies, including the entire European Union, but also China, Mexico, India, Japan, and other places, not including Canada, oddly, but to under a provision of the Trade Act of 1974. And the idea is this can reinstitute tariffs in a way that the Supreme Court hasn't addressed. So it's basically an end around the Supreme Court decision. It's on kind of a fast track to announce these investigations of alleged violations of this 1974 Act. And when you think about it, what are the violations? Well, that these economies have structural excess capacity and production and manufacturing, with the idea that that burdens U.S. Interests.
But so if you have overcapacity, you're essentially you're an implied dumper without even proving it.
Yeah. And so if you were trying to analyze this according to precedent and reach a decision, this is the type of thing that takes experts years, or at least a year, to make any kind of analysis, even involving one or two big economies. But this is on a fast track, and I think we know what the decision is going
to
be.
So it's easier to do the study if you know what the back page is going to read.
Yeah, exactly. Just a quick diversion. One time I was giving a talk in Cartagena, you know, it's a very historic city, and it's where most of the witch trials for the Western Hemisphere were held by these Spanish governments. And out of something like 250 years of trials of witches, accused witches, the amazing thing, there wasn't one innocent witch. And, you know, they had ways to ascertain the truth, like loading up the suspect with rocks in a bag and dropping them into water, and if they didn't float, well, they were guilty.
So what do you think happens if somebody who does the report on China comes back and said they're not cheating?
Yeah, well, they may send them to Cartagena.
Or then they're indicted for being a Chinese spy.
Yeah, so I think we know how it's going to end up, and it's on a fast track with public comments accepted through April 15th with a hearing May 5th. And guess who's going to get tariffs? And of course, last part about this is, so these Supreme Court, they got these clerks, they're all brilliant, they all make a lot of money as soon as their clerkships are over, but they couldn't be bothered to give instructions with their tariff decisions about what's supposed to happen, or timetables. And so now we got a whole bunch of expensive litigation of companies that want refunds. So that's underway, but only a few of them, including Costco, have promised to give part of the refunds back to the consumers.
How are they going
to
do that?
Lower prices, but they're supposed to have lower prices anyway, so it's good PR for Costco, which I like, but most of them don't even bother.
I don't think FedEx is going to do that with their shipping rates.
Well, as everybody, you know, whatever people think, I'm this flaming liberal, the fact is I'm very much on the, let's put it this way, the traditional Republican side of this, which is no tariffs. I'm a Ronald Reagan economist to that regard. As much as you can, I want free trade. Now, but I'm very concerned about what Carl says. You can't have a pollution law on your side of the Rio Grande. The guy goes and on the other side of the Rio Grande and pours the same pollution in the same river without having some kind of a penalty. And tariffs could be used to even up those kinds of things and child labor and so forth. But now, that's a whole different reason for him than Trump. Trump, I hope he's not dumb enough to just think that any time you have a trade deficit that somebody's screwing you. Because that is absolutely not true. I mean, if Andrew owns an island someplace that grows cocoa and we want cocoa and we buy it from him, there's going to be a trade deficit. That doesn't make Andrew a crook. It means that we wanted his cocoa. And the idea is that Andrew is going to take the money. He's going to buy something in Britain. He's going to change it for pounds. Somebody over there is now going to have dollars. He's going to go back here and buy something here. That's the way this is supposed to work. But, you know, the idea that the simple fact that you have a trade deficit means somebody's screwing you, that's so sophomoreish. I don't even think it's sophomoreish. It's third grade.
Well, wait a second. Are you saying I shouldn't be planting my banana farm here in Washington, D.C.? Because I was planning to get rich on growing bananas without tariffs.
Well, there you
and
go.
And then Trump wants to, like, do these deals with these countries to on the tariff issue. He put tariffs on Switzerland, and then they gave him, like, some gold clock that was pretty expensive, made by Rolex or some one of those companies over there. And then he decides to drop the tariff. So he's looking at this as, this is a chance for me to make more money.
Well, you know, even Caesar didn't want that kind of power.
You know, no.
I mean,
absolutely.
No, here's the income tax rate for you guys, but for you, I like you, it's a little less. I mean, I mean, this is, it's sort of crazy, but where exactly with this thing, this is becoming pretty serious stuff. Now we've got Chubb involved. We're going to escort these tankers. Well, we already escorted one. Oh, no, we didn't. Now it seems like we're the same guy, Energy Secretary Wright. Now, why he is giving these kind of speeches, I don't know. We're not ready to escort tankers through the strait. Do we think they're mining the strait? Do we not think they're mining the strait? Do we have any minesweepers anymore? We had a contract for four of them in Wisconsin. Didn't we just cancel two of them? By the way, you guys know this. Minesweepers are wood. How many minesweepers do you think we even have, Andrew? Or Wayne, you were in the Navy?
We had four at the naval base. We had over in Bahrain, which I think the Iranians pretty well wiped out. But before all this started, they took those four minesweepers and put them in mothballs at the old Philadelphia Navy Yard. Who makes these decisions? I mean, the guy who he has as Secretary of the Navy, he's all over the Epstein files, this guy Phelan. So, you know, it's you know, I hate to say this, but they had some big, his cabinet had some big shoes to fill, and they haven't even filled those shoes that he gave.
How nice of a ride is it across the open Atlantic in a wooden minesweeping ship?
I was on two of them in 1975 in very stormy seas in the North Atlantic, and I can tell you that the entire crew, including the captain, were seasick, with one major exception: the chief petty officer, the chiefs, the guys that I always say they're the guys that really run the Navy. I was on two Belgian minesweepers, and the chiefs were in the chief's mess during these high seas drinking beer.
Oh God! Well,
no matter how bad the trip is getting over there, I can safely predict that the crew will hope it stretches out for a very long time, because being parked in the strait doing minesweeping work with the drones coming in from Iran cannot be a pleasant assignment.
How many years ago did they mine the straits? It was, they did it once before, and it was
during the Iran-Iraq War of the early 80s.
Well, I seem to recall, and you guys correct me on this, that we were going to escort ships then, but because these tankers are so friggin' big and they're all double-hulled now, that our escort ships sent the tankers through first, because if the mine hit the tanker, we'd do way less damage than if it hit the Navy boat.
Right. And remember, it was only the Kuwaiti tankers that Reagan reflagged with American flags, so it wasn't all of them. Reagan got a lot of, favorable polling results from doing that, but in essence, just reflagging Kuwait's vessels really didn't amount to much.
Well, what do you think is happening? Just to kind of review this, and I'm not an expert, and you guys, again, pile in. Right now, I've read stories that the Iranian tankers are going through the straits and sending the stuff to China. And now Saudi has the ability to pipe oil from the Persian Gulf to the Red Sea, correct? So they're the only place that can divert stuff to another port. The other guys are pretty much stuck in the Gulf, right? So what's happening today? I can't get the story. Is anybody going through there? Or is anybody willing to take a chance still going through there? I mean, what's happening?
Yeah, well, even with them transporting the fuel to the Red Sea, the ships going to Asia still have to pass through the Bab al-Mandeb Strait between Africa and Yemen. And the Houthis are threatening to mine those straits, and of course they've hit some of those ships in that area with missiles. So,
just as a really stupid question, the Houthis look to me like, excuse my French, don't really have a pot to piss in. How exactly would the Houthis next week come up with 500 mines? Who makes mines? I mean, how do you get them there? I mean, how big? I mean, they look like the ones in World War II, the big things with the metal spikes on them. I mean, what are these things?
Yeah, well, Iran has been supporting them. How much they can do that now is anyone's guess. But you talk about places like Yemen and the Horn of Africa, these Djibouti and these other places. These have always been known as huge smuggling centers. So you talk about the port of Aden and the port of Djibouti. You're also talking about the ability to, smuggle weapons and mines and anything you want, because they've been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years. That's just the nature of that beast.
But Andrew, how is it? I mean, I don't know why I always get to my crazy South Side roots here. But I go, okay, we're gonna mine Lake Michigan. All right, so what? We don't have Yellow Pages anymore. But could I open up the Yellow Pages or get the, or you know, mine manufacturers in Chicago to go over and buy like 50 of them? I mean, who makes these things? Where are they? Are they just in are they in storage from World War II or what? To
well,
me, it's
this
like,
is where arms dealers make a ton of money, and so you know, we know more historically about that than currently, because it's inherently secretive stuff. But we know from books and reports of past situations that, to give a very simple example, maybe applied to Lake Michigan, somebody buys stuff and they don't say where it's going. It goes through a whole bunch of different countries and shell companies, and at every point in the commerce stream, people think, well, I don't know who these people are, but there's a nice profit to be made, so let's ship it. And then it ends up, as Wayne suggested, in Djibouti or someplace, and somebody says, yeah, let's give it to the Houthis.
Well, I guess it always, I don't know why I always, maybe because I worked for a, you know, a place where railroad cars were, if the screws and the bolts and the screwdriver didn't all show up on the same day as the guy did to put the thing together, you didn't get anywhere. I mean what are the logistics involved in sending 500 mines, I don't know how much they weigh, from God knows where they are or where they're being manufactured to the Houthis? I mean, it's got to be a little bit of a challenge for somebody.
Well, the people doing it have been doing it a long time, and they're part of a network that they know how to do it, because there's a lot of money involved in doing it, and you don't make it easy for anybody to track what's going on. So, and by the way, that's, I took a little dig at some of the candidates taking various, let's call them new currency types. But a lot of my concern about that is this is one of the ways to hide money in these various cryptocurrencies.
Why wouldn't, my first question, until you brought that up, because I didn't even think of that, my first question is, the biggest single lobbyist in the world now, every one of these guys is running against essentially medical expenses and prescription drug stuff. Are they taking money from the drug companies? I'm guessing they are. Isn't that where a lot of the money comes from?
Well, Big Pharma has always been a huge donor to candidates. I think, Andy, there was a guy in charge of that. He'd been a senator from Louisiana.
Billy Tozen. He was a House leader, and he left a lot of power in the House to become head of the Pharmaceutical Association. This is in the 1990s. They dole out the money, and what they don't want is things like the federal government using its purchasing power to get discounts on prescription drugs. And there's a lot of other issues like that.
Well, next week, maybe if we don't talk about wars and stuff, it's not about getting a discount. It's about somebody not charging $1,000 for something that it costs them a buck to make. And
there's a lot of angles. By the way, I know we're running out of time, but part of it is when you have successful candidates who have benefited from the system, including Rick Scott from Florida, who's head of the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee, and he became, what is he, a billionaire, Wayne?
Yeah, he was the head of basically this company, once called Humana, but he ripped off Medicaid and Medicare to the tune of billions of dollars, and he I guess he pleaded no contest and it was in the trial. And yeah, now he's
civil
suit, right? Yeah, it should. A lot of people here wished it was a criminal trial and still do.
Well, it's what chance does this voting rights thing with Trump shutting down the Congress until he gets his? Is he any chance of getting that through?
Probably not, because if the Senate majority, including the Senate Majority Leader from South Dakota, give up on that, they've really handed over one of their biggest parts of remaining power. If they just go to majority decisions on regular legislation.
You don't think they're going to cave?
No.
I hope you're right. Hey, guys, have a nice, anything crazy going on this weekend, or are you just lounging?
We don't lounge.
Okay, whatever.
But we do crazy with the proper invitation.
Well, there you go. So, but Wayne, you're in Florida?
I am.
All right, well, one of these days when you go to Washington, I'm going to have to find and make a field trip or something. SP Futures down 40. NASDAQ Futures down 139. Nice job, Jimmy. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
This is Bob Uecker saying thanks for watching.
All right, I'm going to be on with Joel here at 9 o'clock.